to the Narrow Path radio program, hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
Our first caller today is Wayne from Sacramento, California. Wayne, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going, Steve?
Good, thanks.
Okay. I don't know how to start. I've been overthinking it. But my situation basically is when I sleep at night, I don't get sleep. I have these dreams just that aren't normal, like dreams of demons, dreams of end of the world, dreams of just crazy things that, you know, normal, like people don't normally have. And I sleepwalk and I wake up screaming. I'm running. I'm a truck driver. I've ran out of my truck. I don't know what I'm running from. Sometimes I'll wake up and I'm filled with anger because I know what it, I don't know what it is. I feel like it's spiritual. I don't know what it is, but I'm mad walking around the house. Like, where are you at? Like, what is this? Like, leave me alone. It's just it's all over the place. I can't really say it all, but that's basically what I'm dealing with.
Yeah. And well, when did those dreams begin?
You know what? It's been going on for a long time. When I hit about 20 years old, I'm 25. When I hit about 20 years old, it just started off slowly. Little dreams, and then I started sleepwalking, and then I started getting these dreams. Like, I gave myself to God. I'm married now. I go to church. You know, I'm not a bad person. I don't do bad things.
When did you get married? How long ago?
A year ago.
Did before you got married, did you tell your wife about these things, walking in your sleep and things like that?
Oh man, I was wild then. Partying, sleeping, sleeping around. Just party. Mainly a party life.
Yes. So when did you give your life to the Lord?
About 2 years ago.
About 2 years ago?
Seriously.
What changed
then? I've always been in church.
Okay, yeah. What changed then 2 years ago when you gave your life to the Lord? Did your life change in any way that you could describe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say I fell in love with God. It was exciting, you know, and it would go away. You know, I would get all excited, like, oh, God is, you know, looking out for me. It's stopping. It's slowing down. And then, bam, it hit again like crazy. And I'm like, God, where are you at? Where are you at? Why is this happening? Yeah. And I would just go hard. And it's still there.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, you know, it sounds like it could be demonic. I believe in demonic attacks. I even believe in demonic possession. And unlike some people, I even believe that a person can carry their demonic possession into their Christian life after they're converted. Some people think not. Some people think that if you're a Christian, you are automatically exempt from being demon possessed. So I won't get into that argument. I'm just saying I believe there is a possibility that you may have come into a very negative relationship with demonic powers before you were a Christian in your lifestyle that you were in before. And that even though you've repented of that lifestyle, you might need deliverance. I don't know. I'm not an expert on deliverance. I'm not an expert on demons. I'm not really one who goes chasing after demons. But I do know that sometimes Christians, once they become Christians, still have some freedom to be acquired that they do not receive just the moment they're saved. And I realize that many people's theology would tell them, well, but we should be completely free of all such things the moment we're saved. And we can talk all we want theoretically about what should be, But I'm just talking about what's reality. There are people who, when they become Christians, they still have bondages. They still have need for deliverance. You know, Simon the Sorcerer appears to be such a case. He got converted through the preaching of Philip. He believed. He was baptized, the Bible says. And then later on, Peter was rebuking him and saying, I see that you're still in the bondage of iniquity. And so it's possible for a person who's been saved and all that to still have something clinging to him from the past. And, right. And that's going to require perhaps additional attention. Now, whether you can manage that yourself by just calling out on the Lord or not, I can't say. Sometimes that can happen. Whether you need some Christians to join in prayer with you, that I can't say, but that might be a good idea. Do you go to church somewhere?
Yes, I go to church, and my pastor prays about it.
So he's prayed about this very thing.
Yeah.
Okay, and what counsel does he give you about it? What does he think about the situation?
It's actually a she.
Okay, what does she think?
And she doesn't really like to get. She's not more into detail. Like, I can't go to her and tell her exactly what it is. She doesn't like to hear about, like, demons and all that kind of stuff. So I tell her I have bad dreams. I'm chased around.
Okay. Well, maybe you need to find a pastor that does want to hear your problems. It's awfully hard to counsel a person about their problems and minister to them if you're not willing to hear what their problems include. I mean, you need to find a pastor who's not afraid of demons, for one thing, because there are pastors who are afraid of demons, and they wouldn't be able to do any good for you anyway, because the demons just have them for lunch. But there are certainly Christian pastors who are aware of the demonic and take it seriously and know how to address it. And if I were in your condition and I were unable to resolve it between myself and God alone, I would definitely go looking for somebody who knew something about these things. I would suggest, interestingly enough, although I'm not a Pentecostal, but I would suggest that Pentecostal and charismatic ministers often are familiar with these kinds of phenomena and might be able to help. But it doesn't have to be charismatic or Pentecostal. There's been many, Baptists and other such folks, Methodists and so forth, who've dealt with demons before. So, I mean, I would just say, your situation sounds like something of a crisis, for sure. And it's something that would, if your pastor's not willing to deal with it or even hear about it, then you need to find a pastor who will. I'm not necessarily saying you need to join the church of such a person that you meet, but there should be lots of pastors, near you in Sacramento who would know something about demons. I would start making phone calls around, ask if you could talk to the pastors of these various churches near you and interview them, sort of like like if you had a disease and were looking for a specialist,
Exactly.
I don't believe that it should require a specialist to deal with demons. In fact, Justin Martyr, one of the church fathers, said that all Christians can deal with demons. And he said, in fact, he was talking to Trifle the Jew, who is not a believer, and Justin said, if you find a Christian and you present a demon-possessed person to them and they can't cast the demon out, then you're dealing with a false Christian. I mean, that's how confident that Justin Martyr was that all Christians could cast out demons. I'm not sure that he's right about that, because some Christians are definitely weak in faith and have other issues that might make them not really adequate. But you need to find somebody who takes this seriously and will be able to minister to you.
Exactly. And can I tell you about one more dream before I get off the line?
All right.
And for the most part, I have dreams like this. I'll be at a party. I see women. I'm able to take the women and have sex with them. And as I'm having sex, or I'm going to the next woman, or whatever, I'll look to my left, and it'll be a little demon there. Like, yes, like, keep going. Like, this is what you want. And I would see people with strings attached to them, like strings attached. I know what you can get from that. They're being controlled. We're being controlled. Mm-hmm. And the dreams, they're so clear. And there's no way that it could be fake. I have it constantly. I've been having this for about 5 years. Same thing over and over.
Brother, why not tell you something? Dreams, as near as I can tell, could come from three separate sources. Some dreams are just your own imagination, I believe. Some of them are just what's going on in your mind. Now, that could be the case with your dreams, but it doesn't. I wouldn't assume it. There may be a spiritual background to this, but I mean, it's possible that your own mind could be presenting these scenarios based on what you know or guilt that you've had from past life.
I would hope so.
Fears that you have, or whatever, you know. That could be just you. But also, right. dreams can come from two other sources. They could come from God, or I'm sure they could come from the devil. Now, you know, you might think these scary dreams would be from the devil, and maybe they are. I don't know if they are or not. That's why somebody who understands the spiritual warfare needs to be able to interview you and spend some time praying with you and so forth. It's even possible that God has given you those dreams to warn you about some of the things that are, you know,
exactly.
things you
That's
did
how I
before.
Seen it with the strings and stuff, right.
Yeah, I mean, God could be revealing something to you. So, I mean, I can't answer this for you because I don't know you.
It's scary trying to find somebody because you can't just trust anybody with this kind of stuff.
Well, you're right.
You know what
you're
I mean?
Right. And, you know, I would say that if you found a good non-denominational pastor who's not necessarily, you know, a demon chaser, but one who believes in the phenomenon of demon oppression,
right.
deception, and so forth. You might even, you know, ask Christians you know what pastors they are aware of in the area if you don't know of any. But if there's any, I wouldn't necessarily go to the pastors of a mega church or something like that because I'm not so sure, you know, that they would deal with those things very often. But sometimes the pastor of a medium-sized or smaller church might have time. And might have had time in the past to deal with other cases that are not dissimilar from yours. Of course, a lot of people listening to me would say you should go see a psychiatrist or just live with it or something else. But
right.
I think there's a chance of something spiritual being behind this that you need to look into. And you need probably to have someone with you doing that.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that. I appreciate it.
All right, well, I'm going to just hope that our listeners will be praying for you because I'm sure there's many who share the concern I have for you from what you've shared. But, you know, the prayers of the saints are powerful, and you may need somebody to pray with you in person.
Right. As of right now, that's all I can do is pray.
Yeah, amen. Well, a lot of times that's all you really can do. You know, sometimes you say, well, I can't do anything but pray, but it's not as if prayer is the last resort or
right,
you know,
exactly.
It's the weakest thing. We've just tried all the good things. Now we have to fall back on the weak thing. Prayer is the most powerful thing. So sometimes there's many situations where there's nothing we can do but pray because nothing but prayer is strong enough to handle it.
Exactly.
All right, Wayne.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
God bless you, brother. Wish I could give you more specifics about that, but I think you're going to need someone locally that can, you know, pray with you and interview you and maybe look in on you from time to time until this thing gets resolved. And I hope that, as I said, listeners who are right now hearing your story will be praying not only right now but regularly for you that these problems will be resolved. They definitely sound to me like they're sinister. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Hello. I have a three-part question about the day when Cain was angry about his offering being rejected.
Uh-huh.
The first thing is, was God attempting to comfort Cain by asking him why his countenance had fallen? And then where would his countenance have fallen from is the second part of it. And the last part of it is, why was he told that he could rule over sin, which was lying at his door, as opposed to waiting by the door or sitting by the door or standing or something like that?
Well, okay. Was God trying to comfort Cain when he said, why is your countenance fallen? Maybe. or maybe just trying to get him to think straight. You know, why are you upset? Where did his countenance fall from? I'm not sure if you understand what it means for the countenance to fall. The countenance means your face. A person's countenance is their face. And it's a Hebrew idiom to say that somebody's countenance is fallen, as we might say somebody has a long face. You know, why the long face is really pretty much the modern way we might say, why is your countenance fallen? So the question of where it fell from is not real relevant unless we say, well, maybe he had a happier face before and it's fallen from there. But yeah, the fallen countenance is simply an idiom that refers to having a sad face. And God might have been trying to comfort him, saying, you don't need to have a sad face. After all, God went on to say, if you do well, like Abel did, then you will be accepted also. So Cain had a bona fide opportunity to do the right thing and to be blessed like Abel. It's not like God predestined Abel to do the right thing and predestined Cain to do the wrong thing. God says, listen, if you do well, you can be accepted too. So that would be comforting, or it could be more of a rebuke. I don't know what the tone was of his saying it. So now, as far as saying, you know, if you don't do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, which is another Hebrew idiom. It means it wants to conquer you. It wants to rule over you. That's what it means. Its desire is for you. It's basically saying sin, and he's kind of personifying sin as sort of a, you know, a mugger or maybe an animal, a predator. It's waiting to pounce upon him and defeat him and conquer him and rule over him. That's what God is saying when he says sin is lying at the door and its desire is for you. And then he says, and you must rule over it. Is basically saying you can't let it rule over you. You can't let it have its desire. Sin wants to control you, but you must not allow it to do so. That's what he's saying. He's basically saying you're going to have to resist this. You already have made a wrong step in offering the wrong sacrifice when you should have offered the right one. Okay, that's strike one. And sin is there just ready to strike you out and control you. And so you're going to have to turn around and do better, and you're going to start obeying, because otherwise you're going to become totally conquered by sin because it's lying at the door ready to pounce on you. So that is essentially the meaning of God's words to Cain.
So would that mean that sin has a body similar to an animal that might pounce on you, or does that have nothing to do with the bodily...
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever been in the presence of sin?
You know, I have to say yes and no, because...
Right. I would say we all have. We're all sinners. Okay, we're all sinners. We all know sin, and it should be obvious that sin doesn't have a body like an animal. What God is doing is using a metaphor. He's saying you are in danger of being overcome by sin, just as if, you know, something was ready to pounce upon you and overtake you. And you need to not let that happen. That's what he's saying. Okay, we're going to talk next to Terrence from Las Vegas, Nevada. Terrence, good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Earlier, a question was brought up about, I even forget because I've been writing down, trying to formulate how I was going to pose the question to you. So let me start with this. Was Mary born a sinner?
Yes. Well, I mean, she was born, she's like the rest of us. She was a human being and therefore born with the taint of sin in her nature.
Okay. You stated earlier, and I've contemplated this before, it just brought it to mind. You stated that as a zygote that Jesus had half of Mary's DNA and that God, I don't get the rest of the supply, the other or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So if Mary was a sinner, it's in her DNA got from Adam, then I know a lot of, or some cults say that then Jesus would be a sinner. And I always thought that I came to peace with it, that Mary was like an incubator. She's just a surrogate that the Lord making Adam from dust. Certainly just there was Jesus before. and that he could have gotten a human form in her womb. So could you help me with that?
Yeah, God just didn't plant a zygote in an incubator in Mary's womb because the emphasis of the genealogies of Christ is that he is descended from David and from Abram. He has to be descended from David or he can't be the Messiah. The Messiah had to be of the seed of David, come from David's own loins. And Mary did. And therefore, since Mary came through David and Jesus then came through her, he came through David. Now, if Jesus was not biologically connected to Mary, other than by an umbilical cord, but if he didn't have any of the DNA or any of the family history of the human race in him, well, then he wasn't really the seed of David at all. Now, the Bible is pretty emphatic that Jesus was a man. And as a man, he had to be connected to the human race through Adam. And his mother would be the one who would have to provide that genetic connection. Now, when I said that God provided the other DNA, I don't know if I'd say that God provided the DNA so much as he provided the genetic information that was necessary to supplement Mary's genetic information. Now, to say that Mary was a sinner doesn't mean that Jesus was a sinner just because he is biologically related to her. The Bible does not tell us that sin is passed down through the DNA. The Bible does not actually address anywhere exactly how the sin of Adam is passed down through the race, but it's not necessary to assume it's through the DNA. As far as we know, DNA only confers to us our natural physical properties, whereas sin would be a moral, spiritual kind of phenomenon. And I don't know. There's been lots of speculation about where does the sin come from. Does it come at the time of conception? Is it carried in the DNA or what? I don't know the answer to that because the Bible doesn't even seem to address it in any way, as near as I can tell. Some people say, well, when David said, "In sin my mother conceived me," that this means that he inherited sin from his mother. Well, maybe, but this is not necessarily stated that way. I mean, "In sin my mother conceived me" sounds somewhat ambiguous and could mean more than one possible thing, some of them scandalous. But the point is that just because Jesus had human DNA brought from his mother, it would not mean that he was a sinner just because she was a sinner. Sin is in the spiritual nature of a person, and it's not a physical trait, I don't believe.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you. That helps clarify that. Okay, because I was reading DNA in the wrong definition then.
Well, I said DNA, but what we're really talking about is genetic information.
Right.
In conception, the male and the female both contribute genetic information through their DNA to create the new child. Obviously, Mary's DNA alone would not contain sufficient genetic information without some supplementation, and whatever was needed, whatever a man normally would provide, was provided instead miraculously by God. That would be at least the most natural way for me to understand the virgin conception of Christ.
Is that confusing that with chromosomes, like they say the Y chromosome's missing in certain people? Or
well, I don't think you're confusing it with that necessarily, but the thing is, the whole genetic picture of reproduction was somewhat, altered in the case of Jesus. Although he had human genetics, a full set, including a Y chromosome, he nonetheless did not, receive, as far as we know, anything through genetics that would make him a sinner. I'm not sure that any of us receive our sinfulness through genetics, but how it is that we're all sinners is something that is only affirmed to be true, and we can observe it empirically to be true. Everybody sins, but we're never told exactly why we're sinners, and the Bible does not affirm that it comes through the DNA. If it does, we're not told so. And some people say it comes through the man's DNA, not the woman's, so that would mean that Mary, even if she had sin in her DNA, there was no man to bring that sin into Jesus. There's some who argue that way, but the Bible doesn't say that either. Just guesses, just educated guesses, I suppose. I only have about a minute before we're going to have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. We have some of our stations leave the network at the half-hour point. The program goes on for an hour, that is another half hour. And if you are listening to a station that actually leaves the network at this point, you can hear the second half of the program by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where we stream the program live and we archive it for later. There's also a podcast, and there's also our internet, our telephone apps, which you can listen to the program all the way through on those apps. And they are free, so you might want to check those out. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we pay for the radio time. We buy the time on the radio. There's no one paid at The Narrow Path. I'm a volunteer. Everyone's a volunteer. We got a lot of people who volunteer, but nobody gets paid a penny, and no one receives any benefits. But we do take the money that is given, and we give it to radio stations so that we can stay on the air, and that's what we do. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want to from our website, thenarrowpath.com. But thenarrowpath.com is a resource for you to take things for free. Everything is free there. Or you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned. In about 30 seconds, we will be right back to continue the program for the second half hour.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome to the Narrow Path radio program, hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
Our next caller in line is Sandra, calling from Chico, California. Sandra, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions, if possible. The first one is, since I've been listening to you, my husband and I listen to you, and we also avail ourselves to your teachings online, I have become interested in the discipline of biblical exegesis.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really looking for anything, advice you can give to get started with that, maybe steps, guidelines, parameters.
Yeah. Now, have you ever listened to my series, The Authority of Scripture?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Not yet.
Near the end of that series, there are some specific lectures about how to study the Bible. And it would be about exegesis. But exegesis, for those who don't know, is a reference to the process of interpreting Scripture in such a way as to draw its meaning out. In other words, the meaning that was put in there by the writer or by the Holy Spirit, the meaning that was intended, that the reader draws that meaning out of the passage by consideration of the words used, the grammar of the sentence, the context and the flow of thought, and things like that. And that's in contrast to what many people do with the Bible, and that is called eisegesis. Eisegesis is to read into the passage something that you want it to be there. And many Christians, including preachers, do this. They've decided that they think the Bible says a certain thing or should say a certain thing, and then they read that meaning into passages from which that meaning could never be drawn out. That is, you could never get the idea that this is the meaning the author had in mind. This is the meaning that the interpreter wants to get out of it. So if you read a meaning into a passage of Scripture, that's eisegesis. If you read the meaning, the intended original meaning out of it, that's exegesis. Now, I mentioned, you know, you get the meaning of a thing by considering the words that are used and, you know, the vocabulary. you're likely to misunderstand a passage if it uses vocabulary unfamiliar to you, because you won't know what it's saying. You won't know what the sentences mean, first because you don't recognize the words, and then also you have to understand the grammar. Because some of the sentences in the Bible, as well as other writings that are not the Bible, are complex sentences. And there are clauses that are subordinate to other clauses, and there are modifiers that modify certain parts of the sentence and not other parts of the sentence, and so forth. This is basic grammar, and, you know, a person might feel, oh, wow, I didn't really do real good in grammar in school, so I probably wouldn't do this well. Well, you might not do it as well as someone who did well in grammar, but frankly, grammar is something that we all know somewhat intuitively just as part of learning to speak. Now, some people are poor speakers and don't use very good grammar, but most of us have a real intuition about grammar to a certain extent if we pay close attention to what is said and not just read over it real quickly and getting first impressions. But grammar and vocabulary are very important considerations. And when it comes to vocabulary, of course, the Bible's not written in English originally. It's written in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek, and we access it through English translations. But you can easily get books and resources that will give you access to the original languages and their meanings. And these resources are written for people whose native tongue is English. And lexicons, you know, expository dictionaries, concordances and stuff are readily available for that.
Great. That sounds wonderful. And I do see that I'll look at the authority of Scripture that you have there. Are there any warnings that you might just want to throw my way as I delve into this? And my husband's very good with grammar, so we can do it together.
Well, I'll tell you, the warning I would give you is that you have to realize that a translator may not be representing the vocabulary and the grammar of the original perfectly. And that's why it's really good to have some of these additional books if you want to do serious Bible study, to get a concordance, a lexicon, Greek. I would suggest that getting an interlinear Bible is a really helpful thing. Now, what that is, that's a Bible that has the actual Hebrew words with the English words under each word. And then it has the Greek words in the New Testament, has the English words, the literal translation under each one. Even those, you know, sometimes a word that they have to translate has more than one possibility. But some of these interlinear Bibles actually have over each word a number which codes to some notes in the back or somewhere that, or the Strong's Concordance or some other resource that tells you something about the grammar or the, you know, what tense the word is in and things like that in the original. What you'd look for would be an interlinear Hebrew-English Old Testament or interlinear Greek-English New Testament. And then the other thing I would just say, the possibly the most important thing that is neglected in exegesis is context. And that is, everything that is said in the Bible has several contexts. One is the immediate context. You know, what does the sentence before it say? What's it talking about? What direction is the conversation going? That's going to have a lot to say about what this next sentence probably is going to be talking about. Then there's, of course, the context of the whole book that it's in, because a book like Galatians or a book like Colossians or a book like Romans has a certain theme that's writing about, and sometimes a verse would mean something just as a standalone verse without any context, but in the context of Galatians or Romans or something, it may very specifically refer to a point that he's making throughout his whole argument of the book. So context, knowing the whole book that you're studying is very valuable. And then, of course, there's the context of the whole Bible, because sometimes a verse in the New Testament is interpreted for us by something in the Old Testament. So God is going to be consistent in what he teaches, in what he says. And so if he says something in one place, many times things that he said on the same subject in other places in the Bible will be helpful or even necessary to understand what he means in an ambiguous statement somewhere else.
That makes sense. Thank you so much for that. And one more, I think the thing that I'll be looking for is, to start with, is the idea of salvation and security. I think it was about a week or so ago you were talking with a woman, and it just kind of rattled me about, you know, the once saved, always saved, and not sure. So I'll probably be looking at that as the first step in the exegesis, but I was wondering what your opinion is on the prodigal son. I know that he did end up coming back to the Lord, but I was thinking, well, you know, while he was away, the father didn't stop being his father. So I was wondering if there is a connection there between someone comes to the Lord and then backslides, walks away for a while, and what the salvation situation
in the story of the prodigal son, Jesus is explaining his rationale for allowing the tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners who were coming to him, allowing them to be part of his movement because they were repentant. And he was criticized by the religious people for the company he was keeping, because the people who were coming to him and repenting and becoming part of his movement were sometimes the more scandalous outcasts of society. And he told the story of the prodigal son to clarify that these too were children of God who had gone astray. And the father rejoiced to have his prodigal come back. And it was the older brother who had never gone astray that was resentful that the father was accepting this sinful son back. So the older brother who resented this is like the Pharisees, who didn't like the fact that Jesus was allowing these publicans and sinners to be in his movement. And the prodigal son is like the publicans and sinners. Now, I will say this. In the context of, in which Jesus was speaking, he was speaking to Jewish people about Jewish society, and therefore the assumption was that the man and his two sons were Jewish. It doesn't have to be. He could have been a Gentile man with Gentile sons, but they would have assumed them to be a Jewish family, because we don't know that Jesus ever gave stories about Gentiles, because he wasn't speaking to Gentiles. And therefore, he was seeing these tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. They were Jewish people who had wandered away from the law, wandered away from the covenant. They had drifted from God. But through Christ's influence, they were now coming back to God, like a prodigal who had left home and was coming back. Now, you said, but the prodigal was still his father's son even when he was away. Well, this is true. But what do we mean by son? Because although we are sons of God in a special sense, owing to our being born again, there's a lesser sense which all people are sons of God. Adam was called a son of God in the book of Luke, chapter 3, the last verse in Luke 3 says that Adam was a son of God. When Paul's preaching to the philosophers in Greece, he says, one of your own poets says we are all his offspring, meaning God's offspring. And he says, since we are his offspring, we must not think he's made of wood or stone or things like that. So Paul agrees, in a sense, we're all God's offspring. Not all are saved, but all have come from God. Now, some of us are his offspring in a unique sense because we've been born again, and now we're his children in all the privileges of sonship. The prodigal son was the product of his father's, family, just like all human beings are the products of God's creation. But the ones who are fallen away from him are not in a relationship with him and do not benefit from that relationship. All people were made by God, but some people are in no relationship with their creator and therefore derive no benefit. Consider this. When the son came back to his father said, my son was lost, but now he's found. My son was dead, but now he's alive. Now, all the while, he saw him as his son, but he was a dead son. He was a lost son. And therefore, I think what we could conclude is that even though the son was still biologically and chronologically, historically related to his father, he had no advantage of being his father's son. He had disowned his father, and he was no longer really part of the family. As far as his father was concerned, he was dead and lost. But when he came back, he was alive and found. So, I wouldn't make too much on this issue of eternal security from the idea that the son, even when he was away from his father, was still his son. He was his son, but he was his dead son. And we could say that about someone who has cut themselves off from God deliberately, because they're still people who were born of God at one time, but they're dead and lost. until yes. they come back into relationship.
And that statement that he was lost and now he's found and dead and alive, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, wonderful. I thank you very much for that clarity and for your help with the exegesis.
All right, so thank you for calling, Sandra. God bless you and your husband as you study.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Steve from Bellevue, Washington. Steve, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, this is Steve.
Hi, Steve.
So one of my favorite proverbs is the first to present his case seems right till another comes forward and questions him. So
yes,
you're
Proverbs
the guy
14.
I go to when I have questions about something that I've read or heard. So, and do I remember it correctly that you understand Hebrew?
No, I don't read, or I actually don't read Hebrew or Greek, but in 45 years of teaching, I've got a lot of anecdotal information about Greek and Hebrew, but not a comprehensive.
So here's my question, and I'm reading this book called The Book of Mysteries by Jonathan Cahn. It's 365 mysteries, one for every day, and it's just one page. But the one that was interesting resonated with me because I think it sort of addresses the puzzle of the Trinity. And he says that in the beginning, God created. And when you translate that, as he translated in the Hebrew, I'm going to read this phonetically. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but Reshit Bara Elohim. And he says the Elohim, because it ends in I-M, means it's plural.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Bara, the verb, is for singular.
That's right.
So what it's telling me is, we have a triune God, but it's just one God. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, I agree with the Trinity doctrine, of course, so I agree with your conclusion. And I even think that those words at the opening of Genesis support that conclusion. There are people who've reached different views about the connection between that plural and singular, but you're right. Bara, the word for create in Hebrew, is in the singular form. That is the form that would be required if the subject of the sentence is singular. And the subject of the sentence is God, and yet the word Elohim is a plural form of a word. In Hebrew, when you add the im, which in our language would be the letters I and M, im, when you add those at the end of a Hebrew word, generally that's how you make it a plural word. Like we in English commonly would add S at the end of a noun to make it plural. There are exceptions, but that'd be the most common way. So Elohim is a plural form, and in fact, there are passages in the Bible where Elohim is translated as God's plural, and that's because sometimes the Bible talks about the false gods, the gods of the heathen, the idols that are not real gods at all, but they are called the Elohim, the gods of the pagans, of the heathen. Now, Elohim, therefore, can mean gods, but in many cases, strangely, it is reference to the one God, and the way we know it is by the grammar, like you were saying. It's in a sentence where the verb requires a singular subject. So Elohim, a plural form of word, is being treated as a singular word, and that's why the translators in those places translate it as God rather than gods. So Elohim, depending on the grammar of a sentence and the place in the Bible, can be translated God or gods, but most often it's translated as God. It's one of the several words that's used to describe the true God in the Old Testament Hebrew. And like you said, because of the verb form, that's how we know. And because there is that mixing of the plural in the vocabulary and the singular in the grammar, it does hint at God being both plural and singular, being one and more than one. And that, I believe, is supportive of the Trinity doctrine, as you say.
Yeah, I like that. So where Elohim is used elsewhere in the plural, I suspect the verb following that word would be a plural verb.
Yes, yes it would.
Yeah, so this does speak to the Trinity. Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Steve, thank you for your call.
All right, bye.
It's good talking to you. Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Tony from Rochester, New York. I was just reading this morning about in Charles Finney's autobiography about a revival in Rochester, New York in 1830. A great revival was there, but it's been a while. We could use another one. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Steve. Could you please explain Matthew 7:6? And my wife and I will listen off the air.
All right. It'll take me a moment to turn there, since I don't use a computer program here. All right. And you're going to go off there? Okay. We'll talk about it. Matthew 7:6 is in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." What I believe he's saying here is that there are certain people who are comparable to dogs and to swine in the particular sense that he's talking about. Of course, there's no human beings that are really worth no more than animals to God, but there are some who have the characteristics of these animals that he's referring to. Namely, they do not understand the value of a thing. You can't give a whole, you know, in Israel, where Jesus lived and taught, there was meat that belonged only to the priests. They would take a sacrifice animal, they'd kill it. The worshipers would eat some of it. Some of it would have to be burned. And some of it would be given to the priest. And this was his portion. It was holy. It couldn't be used for anything else. You couldn't just take it out and feed your dogs, for example, with that meat. You could use other meat, but not that meat, because holy meat was dedicated to God and could only be used for divine purposes. Now, you don't take that meat and give it to dogs. One reason is that a dog doesn't know the difference between holy and unholy. A dog doesn't have that capacity. It doesn't know about religious differences like that. And like pigs, they don't value a pearl. If you throw a pearl at a pig, it doesn't know the difference between a pearl and a pebble. And therefore, a pearl, which is valuable to us, because humans have the capacity to evaluate things like that, would be totally unappreciated by a pig. You know, you throw pearls at me, I'll be happy. I'll collect them up and sell them and use the money for something. Pig, he doesn't see it as a generous act. He sees it as a hostile act, and he'll turn and trample those underfoot and turn on you. Jesus was familiar with some, I guess, some fairly aggressive pigs, and there are some. And the idea here is that there are people like that. What is holy? What is valuable? They don't have the capacity to know. They don't know, you know, spiritual things from anything. They don't know what true values are. Now, what we have is something of great value. We have the message of salvation of souls. Jesus said, "What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" Obviously, a man's soul is worth more to him than the whole world, at least in the true valuation of things. Men often don't know that. They would rather have the whole world than have their soul saved. And yet we have the message, which those who appreciate it know to be the most valuable thing in the world. It's the pearl of great price, the kingdom of God. We offer this to people. But many times we'll find that when we try to bring Christ to people, when we try to bring the message of salvation to people, they don't recognize it as a valuable thing. They don't see it as a holy thing. To them, it's just your opinion. It's just you saying that they are wrong. It's you being judgmental. It's you criticizing. And so they get upset. And instead of being receptive, they turn on you. And they criticize you. In some cases in history, they've attacked Christians, even killed them. And this only because the Christian was trying to spread the gospel. And so what I think he's saying is, better watch out. There are people who, if you share the gospel with them, they will have no capacity to appreciate it, and they'll only turn on you. So you don't want to waste your time with people like that. Now, of course, the question arises, how do you know if they're that kind of person? Well, you don't until you try. You know, I mean, if you begin to share the gospel with them and you find that they are not listening or dealing honestly, or they're devaluing or blaspheming or whatever, then I would say find somebody else to talk to. Don't be wasting your goods, your treasures, on those who have no appreciation of them. And I think that's what Jesus is no doubt saying here when he says don't give what is holy to dogs, and don't cast your pearls before swine. And they don't realize that you've offered them something of great value. But they don't have the capacity to recognize great value in this area. You know, it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 14 that the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God because they're spiritually discerned and they think they're foolish. So there are people who are not spiritually minded, people who are just worldly minded, and they're not really going to be the people that you'll do well to spend your time evangelizing. Now, you might do well to do pre-evangelism with people like that.
Let's talk to Beatrice from San Pedro. Beatrice, thanks for calling and waiting.
Hi.
Welcome. Hi.
I want to know, what's the difference between telling someone about someone's event that happened during the day and biblical gossip?
The difference between reporting something that happened innocently, on the one hand, and gossip, on the other hand, is the element of innocently. It's a matter of motivation. Gossip is generally something that you're telling somebody not because they need to know it, but because you think they will like to hear it from you. And I mean, a lot of times we're not thinking very clearly about this. Whenever we tell a story about somebody else who's not present, we really ought to be saying, let me think about my motives here for a moment, because we talk so freely without thinking about our motives that many times our motives are not good and we don't catch it. But we need to ask, when I begin to talk to somebody about somebody else who isn't present, and what I'm saying about that person who's not present is not altogether flattering. It might even be something that would be a little embarrassing for them to be told. Why am I doing this? Why am I telling this? There's two possible reasons. One would be because the person being told needs to know. If you know that a woman's husband is cheating on her and she doesn't know it, then telling her that he's cheating is not gossip. She needs to know that. There are people who are part of the problem, and there's people who are part of the solution, and there's people who are genuinely, legitimately interested parties who need to know things. In such cases, speaking negatively about somebody who's not present may be necessary, and it may be the loving thing to do because you're seeking to resolve a problem. However, we might easily convince ourselves that we have such good motives when in many cases no such motive is predominant. We all know that people like to hear gossip. You know, that's why tabloids sell by the hundreds of millions at the supermarkets. People want to hear gossip about someone else, even about someone they don't know personally, someone that's famous or all the better if it's someone they know personally. They'd love to hear, you know, some dirt on somebody that they don't like very much, it may be. Or maybe even someone that, well, they might admire the person, but still envy them, and they'd like to hear something that tears them down. Now, we know that the sin in us somehow responds favorably toward morsels of gossip. And it says in the book of Proverbs that the words of a backbiter or of a gossip are like tasty morsels that go down deep into the belly. That means that people like them. People enjoy them. People like to hear gossip. And we know that we like to hear it, and we know that other people like to hear it. So one way to be popular with people is to have some dirt to tell on somebody that's not there. And well, you know, when you're sitting around with friends and so forth, if you happen to know something about someone that they don't know, then you telling it, you know, might make you seem like you're in the know and you're somebody that people should hang around with because, you know, they would learn things that they'd like to hear. However, the desire to be liked by knowing something negative about someone else is not a good motive. It's not a good reason to tell on somebody else something that's negative. Anyway, a great deal more could be said about gossip if I had more time, which I do not. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. You can write to the Narrow Path at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or our website, thenarrowpath.com. God bless you.